Hello and welcome to the Data Journalism Podcast. My name is Simon Rogers. I'm a data journalist, speaker and teacher and data editor at Google.
And my name is Alberto Cairo. I am a professor of visualization at the University of Miami, an infographics designer and journalist, and also a book author.
We love using data to tell stories, and the music you can hear is the sound of data made with Two-Tone, an app that turns numbers into tunes. It's also the sound of climate change from a Guardian story connected to our interview today.
And this is the Data Journalism Podcast, the only podcast, as far as we know, and at least for now, that dissects the latest trends in data journalism around the world. In each episode, we will explore the latest in data journalism, and we will chat with some of the world's top data journalists. You will get to find out how they do what they do.
So subscribe at datajournalismpodcast.com to see how data is changing the world of journalism forever.
Forever. How are you doing, Simon?
I'm good, Alberto. How are you doing?
Doing all right. What do we have this week?
So we have a bit of a trip down memory lane for me, but also very much a kind of a trip ahead as well. We are chatting to Pamela Duncan, Ashley Kirk, who are part of the data journalism team at The Guardian.
Oh, that sounds lovely. Unfortunately, I couldn't join that conversation. Perhaps we should disclose this to our listeners that you were in the UK and you sent me a calendar invite for 3 a.m. in the morning. And I said, no way, I'm not going to do that.
Not even for The Guardian.
Yeah.
We had a great chat. I was really interested in seeing how the operations changed there since I left, which is a little while ago now. And we had a great chat about how data journalism works there now, how integrated it is into the news operation.
Yeah, that's so interesting because I remember when I started my career in online journalism back in the late 90s, and there were so few news operations all over the world producing data visualizations and infographics, interactives. It was just El Mundo, El País in Spain, the Chicago Tribune, the New York Times, and a few others, and then The Guardian. I mean, The Guardian was one of the pioneers in online journalism, and also in online data graphics, which is my world.
Yeah, well, obviously, it's my ancestral home, definitely kind of my introduction to that world. And yeah, when we started, we were kind of pretty much alone in that field, and now it's not, and now there's much more competition. But I think there is still a kind of unique approach that The Guardian has, which feels very kind of true to what it represents as a news organization. And we had a great time chatting about that and how they work day to day, and also the kind of the theory about how newsrooms should really represent data and be open about data and transparent too.
Super exciting, super interesting, and I believe that also super informative. So let's jump right in.
Let's jump right in.
My name is Pamela Duncan, and I am the data projects editor with The Guardian. I also, in my spare data journalism time, teach data journalism in conferences all around the place, and have previously developed curriculums to teach journalists who in countries where data journalism is sort of still emerging.
And I'm Ashley Kirk. I'm visuals editor at The Guardian and also visiting lecturer in data journalism at City University London.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. I've really been looking forward to this conversation. Let's kick off with a quick look at the way The Guardian does data journalism now. So maybe, Pamela, if you could talk through a little bit about how data journalism works. I know it's organized across different teams and different teams work in different ways. So maybe you could kick off with that.
Well, I mean, I think we better do a full disclosure here that Simon used to have something to do with data journalism.
I was going to say that, but yeah.
But there was always obviously a graphics and visuals element to journalism in The Guardian. But I think in 2009, I think it was 2009, Simon, the data blog was established. And at the time, although, there was computer assisted reporting in the States prior to this, there was good data digging work coming out of the Nordic countries, so the Nordic pioneers in Scandinavia were doing really good data work, even from the 1990s. But in 2009, the Guardian established a data blog, which kind of revolutionized the way that data was viewed within the newsroom in the Guardian, and I think probably was the forerunner for a lot of what came after it. And at that time, and it seems really strange for me to be saying this when you're on the call, so maybe you can say what it looked like at that time, and then I can say what it looks like now. That might be a better way of doing it.
I mean, I can tell you what we had at that time. Basically, there was me, and there were people who were kind of interning. So Mona Chalabi was one of the interns, and John Burr Murdoch, another, and Amy Sagey. But we weren't the only people doing data stuff, because there was an interactive team who were producing visuals, and then we worked really closely with the graphics team. So things have moved on a bit since then, I think.
But how, like, sorry, I feel like I'm interviewing you now, but like, because I feel that then it was quite a different offering to what it is now. Mm. So, in the very early days of the data blogs, I remember interviewing you in 2012 for a piece that we did, 2019 for the 10-year anniversary of the data blog. And I remember looking back at some of the very early data offerings, and it was sort of like, it was nearly like you were giving a platform for the data rather than necessarily writing it through. And that evolved over time. And I think the two big things in that was the WikiLeaks and then the London riots, where, and to my mind, that was like completely amazing, because what that piece did was to build a data set that didn't exist. In such a really quick turnaround manner for something that complex. And to my mind, that's still the sort of data journalism that we do today. So I think in certain ways, there are threads between what was happening in the Guardian on the data blog in 2009, 2011, 2012 in those instances, and then what's happening right now. I think in the meantime, data journalism has evolved. Yeah. And we have far better tools at our disposal than we did in 13 years ago, 14 years ago. And I think that there's sort of like, there's been an evolution within the community of like how data works, and like we've all been building on one another's ideas. So I think the difference between the type of journalism that we do now and the type of journalism that was happening then is that, firstly, the journalism is like the data blog, in a sense, was sort of like oftentimes it was an add-on to like the kind of the newsroom journalism that was happening, as in like it wasn't being really like subsumed into those stories, and it was sort of like a standalone product. When WikiLeaks and the London riots happened, you can see how it started driving the news. And now, 14 years later, what we're seeing is that data is at the actual core of the newsroom. You know, like we sit both physically and metaphorically somewhere between the news desk and investigations. And I think the realization is that data can and does feed into so many stories now in a way that, you know, I don't know if in the early 2010s, if it was sort of seen as kind of novel, you know, nearly, but like now it's just such a kind of part of the newsroom language and thought process. And I think that that's the main change.
I hear people used to snicker in news meetings, if there was a data story, it'd be a little bit of, there's a data story, like it was a funny thing inherently. But Ash, before we get too deep into that, Ashley, tell us a bit about what you do as well.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking, talking about changes, right? You know, you mentioned the interactive team. So I guess that's evolved into what we now call the visuals team. Mm. Mostly, I guess, because of the big shift while we still do interactives, it's probably not what we, you know, think of first of all, because, you know, like the majority of our readership is on mobile, and a lot of interactives that you probably would have done then definitely don't work on, you know, a small screen. And so therefore we think much more about, you know, the wider umbrella term of visuals and, you know, all of the different things that encompasses in terms of like static visualization, or, you know, maybe a bit more of a walkthrough in terms of like scrolly telling or something like that. But of course, as Pamela hinted at, you know, it involves data journalism as well. You know, we have journalists on our team that, you know, I would say the majority of the pieces we do involve digging into data, finding a story and communicating that visually. You know, we still write up stuff, but, you know, the primary reason we're in the newsroom is so we can utilize all of the different ways that we can visualize data and the stories to communicate them better to readers. So we, even though, you know, we've got the data journalists under Pamela on the data projects team, you know, we still do a lot of data journalism on the visuals team as well.
So how do you two kind of coordinate day to day? Like, what's the mechanics of running a big data operation across a big news organization now?
Yeah, well, so maybe I'll just talk about the team structure a little bit. So we've got, you know, we've got Pamela as a data projects editor, myself as a visuals editor, and Lucy Swan as the news graphics editor, the managing the more day-to-day stuff. And then the big umbrella of the data and visuals team is headed up by Lydia McMullen, the head of visuals and data journalism. And basically every morning we get together at 9:45 and we basically just talk about, first of all, the daily priorities and then what every member of the team is doing. And, you know, the data team is going to that, we're going to that, Lucy's going to that. So then we kind of, you know, we just discuss what everyone's doing. So that's where we can ask for help. You know, if a particular project, you know, needs a particular person's expertise on something, but also that's just how we keep in touch to make sure, you know, we're not crossing over anything, or, you know, making sure that we all know what everyone else is doing.
Yeah, I would add to that, like, lots of communication. Like, Ashley and I, there are days where, like, even he got on the call this morning and I was like, oh my God, not you again. You know, like, we talk kind of like every day, sometimes several times a day if we've got a project on. And yeah, so like, there's a lot of, yeah, we just chat a lot and G-chat a lot and go to the pub when we can. And that seems to help a lot.
Over-communication, very important. One thing I was thinking about before chatting to you guys is that when we launched back in the day, big kind of like ethos behind it was literally just, for me, was just making data more available.
Yeah.
There was suddenly all this data out there, but it was all PDFs. So it was hard to get a hold of. Shouldn't we have like a mission, especially the Guardian, shouldn't have like a mission to open up that data and make it accessible and understandable? But I think it's evolved beyond that now. I think that's probably still at the core of a lot of what you guys do. But how would you describe your mission now if you were to tell somebody who'd never seen the Guardian or never seen a piece of data journalism there? What would you describe as the way you work?
Do you want to go or will I, Ashley?
Feel like you've thrown me under the bus there, haven't you? Well, I would say, you know, the Guardian is quite unique in terms of, you know, its ownership model and everything, you know, without going into all of that too much. You know, like, I think that gives us a very clear, you know, values and mission. You know, it's about holding power to account. And while some of that, and Pamela can speak more to, you know, building data sets and releasing that, that's part of it, but also just, communicating, you know, stories in data that, you know, reveal abuse of power or, you know, whatever the particular story is. And I think that is our mission, that, you know, often in a data set, there are, you know, very strong stories that the public need to know, but they can be quite complicated. And, you know, just saying that in words, you know, might not be enough. And so therefore, it is our job as visual journalists and data journalists to find that story and communicate so that people understand what is going on in the world. And, you know, I think that is the main mission, I would say.
I think that's a really, like, fantastic way of putting it, like, because, you know, I think that increasingly we just live in a world that's so, there's just so much data, and so much more is always being there's so much data in kind of the bloodstream of society right now. And for things like, I mean, I know we'll probably, have you managed to have a podcast yet where you didn't talk about the COVID pandemic and its impact on journalism? But I mean, you really saw that then, you know what I mean? Where like all of a sudden we were being inundated with all of these data sets, some better than others, telling us different things, you know, like the evolution of like the UK's, you know, COVID data sets, where at first you didn't have deaths counted from nursing homes, for example. And so you've got all of this, you know, huge swathes of information, but actually it's very, very difficult for the public to get a grasp of all of it, because they're not sitting at their computers like going through endless spreadsheets, right? So it's about unlocking stories and really complex stories. And I think also, you know, in interpreting those and really interrogating those to ensure that people get the right understanding of the data. So I think that is like kind of the broad mission. Coming back to your like original point about sort of freeing data and like democratizing data and having it out there. When I started off a possibly Guardian inspired data blog in the Irish Times, and I don't know. Then like one of the kind of core ideas that I had was that I thought that it was like really important for us where possible to publish the underlying data if we could. And in theory, I still love that idea in theory. But I realized quite quickly when I came to The Guardian, the sheer number of data sets that we work on, and the like, if we were to archive all of the data that we work on and analyze for the purposes of journalism, and put those out into the try to publish them, and like crucially also try to keep them up to date, that would be a full time job in and of itself. So I think that eventually I kind of had to let go of the idea of being able to like, publish the underlying data, and probably not something to publish or to put on the podcast. But Simon, we were absolutely ruined with data requests, being like, hey, so I find this Google Doc from 2010 showing like blah de blah. Why aren't you updating that anymore? And we're like, because we're not working on that story. We're not like archivists that are sitting around like, you know, updating police stats from, you know, 2010, 11, 12. So
I'm sorry that I left you with that.
Yeah, no, you should be.
Yeah, we had we realized pretty quickly that, because we'd always assumed that actually the percentage of people that would then go on and try and explore the data would be quite small, but it's actually quite big.
Yeah.
I think it's the trust thing, isn't it? People don't trust it unless they can see the data. And just the simple act of maintaining existing data sets became like a full-on thing. Not that it's not worth, I still think it's a worthy kind of aim to have, but I totally understand, you know, in a fast-moving news environment, that's not necessarily something that you guys can do.
But there are options, right? You know, like usually, yeah. I think wherever, you know, especially if you're dealing with open data, right? You know, we usually, especially if we have a piece that's a bit more complicated, you know, we'll have a kind of methodology section, we'll link to all of the sources, and we'll explain what we did, especially, as I say, if it's a bit more of a complicated piece of data work that we've done. And I think, you know, that is about the same thing, like showing you're working and allowing and being a bit more transparent. And that, I think, can, you know, even if you're not publishing the full data set, it can still help build trust.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely adds to the credibility, I think, that you bothered to put it there. But there's something I wanted to come back to. I do want to talk more about this. There's something I want to come back to, Pam, that you mentioned about COVID. And I really do feel like there's a kind of before COVID and an after COVID set of data journalism. And I kind of feel like before COVID, it was, you know, there was lots, you know, new data journalism outlets becoming established. But a lot of the stuff that I saw was like almost like too clever by half. It was kind of like a lot of showy off. not particularly you guys, but just generally a lot of kind of showy off about how clever the person is doing the analysis and doing something really complicated, and so they can impress their colleagues and stuff. Whereas COVID happened, and suddenly people are having to tell stories to the public with data at a time of huge uncertainty, where the data is the only certain thing you've got, and everything is like fluid. I mean, I know, Ashley, you've done some work on this. I mean, do you want to talk a little bit about the difference that COVID made? Then maybe, Pamela, you could chime in on that.
Yeah, I mean, I do agree with what you're saying. And I think part of it is just because perhaps there has been more interest, like both internally in the newsroom and externally, in data journalism, you know, because we had in COVID, we had a story that, you know, you could not look at without a data angle, right? And so therefore, you know, whereas before, I don't think this was necessarily the case of The Guardian, but I think in general, you know, you may still have had people, you know, data journalists and visual journalists like in the corner of the newsroom and nobody really knows what they do and they're kind of in a bit of a silo. Like news editors needed those people, you know, basically on a daily basis. And so that probably meant that the way that they worked, you know, because they had to, you know, pitch stories to, you know, non-data journalist news editors, but then also for, you know, so that added like sort of, I guess, scrutiny to their work more. So then I think that meant that they perhaps had to think more about, you know, a general readership, which, you know, as you say, probably isn't, you know, as sort of fancy and impressive to other, you know, data journalists in the sort of showy off kind of way, but has a greater utility in a way, you know. I would say perhaps that's part of it, you know, like the sort of move towards a news desk in general, I think, you know, in what we do. Would you agree, Pamela?
Yeah, I think you make them like, there's so many things kind of COVID-y. Like firstly, Simon, what you were saying about like too clever by half, like I was talking to somebody the other day, an aspiring data journalist, and they were explaining some of the things they'd done. And I was like, you know, you're going to have like, you know, they're using these like quite, like, you know, for somebody who came up like through, like, as, you know, first a reporter, then learned a bit of data, then, you know, learned more and kind of built up through, whereas this person is already professional training in something else. So they're using like Strata and OR and stuff. Mm. And they were very, very impressive in the story they were telling me. And I was like, but you do know, right, that if you go into a newsroom tomorrow, that you're going to need to know how a pivot table works, because you know, you can build it in OR, sure, but it needs to be very quick. I mean, you know, you need to be very, very quick on your toes and be able to, at least in the first instance, just be able to describe it to the news editor, like, this is why this is a story, right? And then you can do something more fancy. When COVID came along, I think that, you know, it brought us all back to the basics as well, because in the first instance, we just had to like get the story up as quickly as everybody else, because all the data was coming out all at the same time. To use an Irish phrase, any notions that we had about our data skills beforehand, we were really brought back to brass tacks, right? I think, you know, Ashley, what you're saying about like the visibility in the newsroom, like all of a sudden, you know, data journalists, I remember being, and my colleague being on a podcast at the time saying data journalists were the new rock stars of journalism. And I was like, ah, come on, we've always been rock stars. But you know, like it did give us that visibility. Now, I have a kind of a counter argument to it, which is that I think in some ways it sort of like went too far. So like, I think everybody is getting back to, you know, it, like there's like the sort of like, you know, the post-COVID return to normality and wider society is also reflected in data journalism. So Ashley and I were talking about this the other day, and people often ask me like what proportion of our stories are commissions versus things that we're coming up with. And I would have said prior to COVID that it was probably like somewhere like 70-30, like where either we or colleagues were pitching up to the news desk and then we were getting commissions on the remaining, like direct commissions on the remaining 30%. In COVID, it just all became reactive, you know, and yes, you were spotting stories in the data, of course, and like bringing them, but it all felt like it was just all COVID driven. It was all reactionary, and it didn't feel like data journalism as I love it. And I think we're coming back to that now. But I think there is like a re-education within newsrooms as to what, you know, okay, so what does data journalism look like now? And can we take the best of what the upset of the COVID pandemic meant for data journalism and build on that?
I think that's really smart. I mean, one thing that I think is a theme in stuff you both said, actually, is how as data journalists, you have like two audiences you had to persuade. There's the public, obviously, but the primary audience is your news editors. I talk a little bit more about that, about the process of working with news editors and in the paper, like day to day, and persuading and pitching stories internally to us.
I mean, I think it works slightly differently for our two teams, partly because of the turnaround in a lot of stuff. So obviously, especially with our sort of like bigger visual projects, you know, they can take anything from, well, a couple of days to a couple of months, right? And that is usually not a turnaround that news desks are like working on. So a big part of my job is making sure that, you know, we have involvement from different correspondents or editors at the correct point in a project to manage expectations and make sure people don't think that this is coming tomorrow because it's a big piece of work, but also making sure that we're not just going off on a, on a completely different angle that nobody's interested in once we've done all of this work. I do think though, like I might just be repeating myself here, but it is a very useful exercise, you know, in general, in terms of talking to news editors. You know, they know what they're talking about in terms of what readers want to see. And I often think that if I can't explain one of our stories in a pitch to a news editor, then how are we going to, you know, this is not going to be a good story, you know, because how are we going to explain this to a reader? So it's kind of like a good first check on whether we've got a good story and whether it's too complicated or, you know, we're being too fancy. So it's a very good sense check, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, if you can't do an elevator pitch, like,
yeah,
you're kind of screwed. When I was thinking about doing this podcast, you know, I was thinking about like how, you know, like I feel like this isn't the right term, but it's the best term I've come across. So when I'm making a distinction between what we do and how news desks were set up in the past. So like my distinction is like we're doing data journalism, and then the alternative, like the equivalent or the other side to that is traditional journalism in inverted commas, right? Because I don't think it's very useful for that like distinction to keep on, because and I think it is eroding, because you know I was at a data journalism conference recently, and I was out with a table a table full of Irish journalists actually, and they were all to some extent, so some of them like my friend Carrie, like she's full-on data journalist. That's what she does in her day job. But I was struck by like how all of the journalists at that table had some understanding of or ability in data journalism. And when I was starting off back in the day, 400 years ago, it was sort of like me doing data journalism over there in a corner and other people doing journalism, you know, and I think that thing is coming ever closer. So these aren't very useful terms, but I think sometimes when you're sitting in a newsroom and you're the data person and you're trying to communicate with the news desk has different priorities on a very, very different time scale to what you do, right? And so I find in my career that I have been like constantly proving and reproving what it is that we do. And like sometimes you think you've made this huge jump where you think like, oh wow, okay, I'm like, I'm being understood as a data journalist. And then sometimes like the next commission that comes in, you're like, oh no, that's like, that's not what we do at all. Do you know what I mean? And like, you kind of feel like, I don't know if you guys get this as well, where you feel like there's a constant, like, it's sort of like pushing a stone up a hill, and then sometimes the stone rolls back at you a bit, and then you're pushing it further up the hill again.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. I mean, I always felt like, when I was there, felt like there was one particular correspondent who was somebody I admired a lot, and just didn't really kind of get why we would do data stories. It wasn't his thing. And certainly when I was at journalism school, it was the idea that you would do something with maths, essentially, was like a bit of anathema to, you know, the artist that is a journalist. But when the first time that we did a story together where we added something with the data, it was like it totally changed their attitude. So we moved forward a little bit. But then it kind of was a gradual thing. It wasn't like a dramatic move forward. It'd always be this gradual, incremental kind of motion in the right direction. But you'd always feel like you'd moved maybe half a step backwards as well at the same time. I don't know. It's interesting that you said that, because I think it's reflected in like the career paths for journalists too. So if you were like the home editor, you would see a kind of career path of yourself in the organization. I don't know yet that there is a data journalism kind of career path. But is that? Am I wrong? Has that changed, do you think?
Well, this brings me to something that I was thinking about in answer to the other question about COVID and also collaboration with other desks and everything. You know, I think one interesting thing that the pandemic maybe like changed a little bit is this idea of like data and visual journalists, right? They are generalists, you know, their sort of beat is the format, you know, or the skills that they have, but they're not health data journalists or science data journalists or, you know, whatever it is. But obviously in the pandemic, they kind of were, you know, they stopped this idea of jumping from beat to beat and kind of became like subject specialists. And, you know, they built up a sort of notebook of contacts and, you know, in one area for probably at least a year. And so they got really deep into a particular story. And I wonder, I haven't seen evidence of this yet, but well, a little bit, you're starting to see sort of like, you know, like graphics, visual editor type people, you know, and like, I think a bit more in America, you're seeing this happen a lot, but I think that has some potential in terms of like potential career paths and stuff for, you know, people in data and visual teams that, you know, might be, you know, have hit a roof, you know, maybe they go and move to other desks and, you know, you have data journalists, but they are just like a science correspondent, or even, you know, you could call them like a, I mean, this is a bad job title, but like science data correspondent or something, you know, like that, I feel like would be really good for newsrooms and perhaps is a solution to that problem.
Yeah, Pamela, is there anything you want to add in on that?
I think that, yeah, I mean, like certainly anecdotally, at least I'm hearing about like more specialist roles in certain newsrooms where teams are developing and now, so, you know, like I think, I mean, part of the reason I love data journalism is that I am a generalist, right? Like that I can, that I'm not sort of topic dependent and like I adore that, but I can totally see why people would want to be in, especially when it comes to some of the more specialized visuals, like aspects of data journalism, you know, you kind of, if you're building a particular kind of tool over and over again, you want to become really, really good at that particular thing. So I think there are levels of specialization now in data journalism emerging, and I think that is only going to continue to develop. I think career progression exists now, not necessarily because we're finding all of these new roles and going into specialisms. I think it's going to take a while before there's like, you know, a health data journalism team in a particular newsroom, right? Like, I mean, it's just like, I mean, yes, we're building and building all the time, but it's difficult to see when we're at the point where that becomes where newsrooms can realistically resource like that. What I do think though is that data journalism is spreading, and it's spreading from like from newsroom to newsroom, you can really see how so many organizations are now really investing in data journalism. And it's spreading not just like within the traditional news media, but also like the magazine type formats, like The Economist, places like that. So there are far more opportunities in journalism than there were. There's also like, I mean, if you want to, like, you know, you go down, not strictly the academic route, but there are opportunities to teach data journalism, and you know, both within universities, but also there's a really healthy conference circuit. So I think that there are opportunities for people there. And sorry, one thing I should have mentioned is also, you know, the international organizations like the ICIJ, OCCRP, like all of these organizations where there's amazing cross-border journalism happening. So I think the opportunities for journalism are there. It might not be the traditional, like, I was a reporter, then I became a correspondent, and then it became an editor route, but there's certainly a lot more variety than there used to be.
I guess the final thing I'd add as well, like, even if the career progression thing is slightly problematic, there is other types of progression. You know, like, this is such a broad area that there's so many areas to skill up on, right? You know, we have a very diverse team that, you know, everyone has different skill sets and different specialisms. And we have like knowledge sharing on that. So, you know, someone might not necessarily be like our best mapper on the desk, but then we'll have like a knowledge sharing session on that, and they can, you know, pick the brains of our mapping experts and get better at that. And, you know, so that is an area of progression, which I think everyone values and, you know, that's worth noting.
And isn't that brilliant? Like, I actually think this is like one of my favorite parts of our job, is that you get to play with all of these like things for, you know, like, so, you know, for example, you might go off and do like a particular, like, I write Python terribly. Like, that actually makes me sound like I'm good at it, and I'm not. But I write Python, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm stuck with Python. You know, you're not just in that one groove. You can go and pick and choose and find all these like other different tools with which to do a particular job. And then maybe you never pick them up again. Maybe you like absolutely love them. Dip into or pull out a bit of SQL. Like, I mean, do you know what I mean? Like,
I'm nodding very vigorously to this, because I think there is an over-indexing on like learning a particular tool, like, and becoming like, and just focusing on that tool, when actually for a lot of people, it's just like, you learn the thing you need at the time. Yeah. You might use it for another year or 2 years or something and come back to it later. But it's like, I don't think we should be tied down to tools in that way. But there is one thing I wanted to ask, because I know we don't have a ton of time. We talked earlier about kind of the issues around archiving and like maintaining stuff. And one of the things I loved to do when I was there was you could go to the library and like get the old editions and kind of go through them. I did this piece once on like infographics, like historic infographics from the Guardian. It was like, it was just like I didn't have much else on. I'd had time. I was like pouring through the old papers and figuring out. It just made me think how difficult that would be for somebody to do with the work now in like 100 years. Because none of these things work after a while, like the code stops working. You can't see half the projects that we worked on now. They're all dead, really, apart from old screenshots. Does that kind of worry you at all? Is that something you think about, like, in terms of having a legacy, or do you think it's just like it's more ephemeral than that?
I think it's a big, huge problem. I don't have an answer for it. Like, I would just repeat what you've said, you know, like, you know, exactly for the reasons you said. You know, like, a lot of the pieces that we do, especially sort of like more on the visual interactive side, you know, like, they probably, you know, and we do sometimes like press pages and stuff, so, you know, like, then it is a bit more future proof. But I think it's a huge problem. I think we should probably put more thought into it, but, you know, it is hard to separate, you know, from the day-to-day you know, work of producing this stuff to tackle that. But it's a massive problem.
Well, on that optimistic note, We've got a little pop quiz. So I'm going to ask you a couple of these questions and just really short answers. So Pamela first, if you could keep just one of the tools that you commonly use, which one would it be?
Okay. So when I thought about this yesterday, I was like, right, it's got to be something that's kind of like, you know, it can't just be like, you know, Google Refine or something, right? Because you have like two journals. I really put a lot of thought into this. Okay. Talked about my boyfriend over it last night and everything, like really big question. But sorry, I'll try to do the short response now. So yeah, when I was saying about it, I was like immediately, first thing I was like, Excel, like has to be Excel, you know,
I built
a journalism career in it. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, love it. And then I realized that actually, I can do like a ton of stuff in Excel and I absolutely love it. I use it in real life all the time. Such a good, but I think I have to pick Python because there is a limit as to what you can do in Excel and there are no limits as to what you can do in Python. And in actual fact, I can do everything that I do in Excel in Python and just it's too hard to learn it all on the job. So begrudgingly, Python.
How about you, Ashley?
Yeah, I think I probably have a very similar thought process on that. I think day to day, you know, Google Sheets is what I use, you know, a lot. It does the job. You know, it might not be the thing that, you know, we'll all talk about at conferences and stuff, but it is the thing that does the job and is good to communicate your findings to other journalists in the newsroom and everything. But if I could only use one tool, I think I'd use R. And that's because I can do everything in that. So where, you know, the limitations of, you know, Sheets or Excel, you know, obviously you've got the size of the data set, but also like the visualization options are not great. Whereas obviously with ggplot, I can do a lot of different visualization in that. And I can also style them up, you know, with the Guardian theme and everything. So I can basically take everything from beginning of finding and cleaning data to visualizing that data in R. So I think that probably covers the breadth of everything I do.
Okay, last question, and you can both do this one. But I'll start with you first, Pamela. Pie charts or tree maps?
Oh, so yesterday, Ashley and I discussed this, and he said that there's only one right answer. So I propose that we do a 3-2-1 answer at the same time.
Okay.
Okay, you ready? All right, 3-2-1.
Tree maps.
Pie charts. I'm joking. I just wanted to see.
Go on. So you are tree maps.
I am tree maps.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
I think for like, I think that, yeah, I think there's obvious problems with pie charts. Although I did used to use donut charts when I used to do journalism in the Irish Times, and I did find them useless in certain circumstances. But I think a tree map really expresses, like, you know, it gives an expression, like, they're just better at showing the information than pie charts ever would be.
It communicates the area more clearly, which is the story, and also allows you to do the hierarchy, which you can't do in a pie. I mean, I also prefer donuts to pies, and I'm not one of those people that thinks they should never be used. You know, like, I think maybe if you've got just like two options or something, you know, like, I think people
would be nodding vigorously if you were here today.
But tree maps.
Hilariously, you are totally in line with the vast majority of interviews with podcasts.
It's quite an obvious one, I think.
Pamela Duncan, Ashley Kirk, thank you so much for joining us.
Cheers.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.